This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
My talk is about settlements. Our ancestors moved from camps, I think this is from Paul's book, to Neolithic villages to cities, such as the Maya city of Tikal, shown here. Just a roadmap of what I'll be talking about. First, I'll talk about my approach to early settlements. The bulk of the talk will be from villages to cities. And then we'll go from Teotihuacan to San Diego, not literally, but figuratively. Much of the talk, but not all of it, is from my new book, Urban Life in the Distant Past, which just came out in paperback a month ago. So my approach, I take a scientific epistemology, is we have systematic and objective data. Are terms defined well? Is there testing of hypotheses? And you might think, well, why do I have to say that? But, you know, this is a popular book that came out a couple years ago, Dawn of Everything, about a number of the issues that I'll be talking about. And it fails the scientific litmus test, unfortunately. The intellectual context is I come at this from the social sciences, political economy. Human evolution has little to contribute. We'll see if I get any pushback from Carta on this. And the deep history of cities and urban life. So let's start with what is a city? There's lots of definitions, and I've written whole articles about it. I'm not going to spend much time on it. But a summary is, a city is a settlement where population and institutions are concentrated on the landscape, where they're concentrated spatially. Cities are settlements, which is where people live. So compared to villages, cities have more people, higher densities, more institutions and diversity, and less freedom for the residents. Within anthropology, for a long time, the major focus for archaeology of complex societies was the evolution of the state. How did the state arrive? What caused the evolution of the state? Oh, cities sort of came along for the ride. But there's a new view, which Graeber and Wengrow have in The Dawn of Everything, and also Justin Jennings here in Killing Civilization, which is cities may have arisen before states. Now let's look a little more at epistemology. How did Graeber and Wengrow make that point? Well, they describe one example of a pre-state city and say, oh, we've got it figured out, right? And they're not wrong about their one example, but you know, Jennings takes a more typical scientific approach. He operationalizes his concepts. He takes a sample, a number of different cities, and analyzes them. And so here's what he finds, that of the six case studies, four of them, Çatalhöyük that we've heard about, Cahokia, Harappa, Jenne-Jenno, collapsed. In other words, these developed as early settlements, dense settlements, lots of people, but the people did not want to put up with the problems of dense living. They did not want to put up with having to give up their freedoms to be controlled by social classes and the state, and they collapsed. Whereas Tiwanaku and Monte Alban, actually, in these places, you have the transition to state-level institutions. So just a summary. Camps that we've heard about from Paul, the main drivers of change from camps to villages, I've listed here. A lot of archaeologists think that defense was the most important of these forces generating villages out of camps, but all of these were important. Trevor Watkins talked about villages, and one of the most important drivers of change is what I'm going to call energized crowding, and I'll be talking about that in a few minutes. So I'm going to start with bottom-up forces, and then we'll get to top-down forces. What happens when people aggregate in cities? They eat hot dogs. They play ball games. They get arrested. They gossip. They do a lot of things. But what do these things have in common? Well, there's increased face-to-face interaction. The number of face-to-face pairs in a group increases exponentially with the size of the group. So as you get higher population, higher density, people moving into cities, you have more face-to-face interaction, and this leads to energized crowding. And energized crowding refers to the effects of face-to-face interactions. You have face-to-face interactions, and there are negative effects, negative outcomes, I list scalar stress here, and positive outcomes, which I list economic growth here. So let's go through some of these things. The negative side of energized crowding, scalar stress. There's too many people. Scalar stress can lead to crime and poverty, the urban health penalty, whereas where cities are less healthy than non-urban contexts, and according to some, anemia and social breakdown. You know, I don't want to walk through this alley in New York City in 1890. You know, I got this picture out to show in a class, and I thought, you know, that guy in a bowler hat looks familiar to me. Does it look like anyone? Doesn't that look like Ray Liotta? But then I found out, no, that's not Ray Liotta. Maybe it's his great-grandfather. I don't know. It's a photograph by Jacob Riis, who's a Danish-American journalist, muckraking photographer in the 1890s. So that's a real photograph, folks. So one solution to scalar stress is to modify the built environment. I'm drawing on work by Amos Rappaport and Roland Fletcher here. And in this transition, with responding to scalar stress, you have more permanence. You have a greater concern with privacy. Space becomes more specialized, both within structures and between structures. And streets and public spaces become more prominent. Another solution to scalar stress is to establish neighborhoods. A neighborhood's both a social and a spatial unit. And in pre-modern cities, and in some cities today, neighborhoods are created by bottom-up social interactions, people acting on their own, independent of the authorities. And I think the neighborhood is the most important social adaptation to urban life. In fact, I'm pretty sure, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure that the neighborhood is the most universal feature of cities, the most universal, non-trivial feature of cities throughout the world and throughout time. But neighborhoods are sometimes built by authorities. In Chang'an, had 1 million people in the 7th century, largest city in the world, they laid out the city in terms of walled blocks of neighborhoods. And today, this is what developers do. Here's my little neighborhood in Mesa, Arizona. It was laid out by developers. This wasn't the actions of people. How do I know my neighbors? A lot of the way I know my neighbors is walking my dog. In fact, in some cases, I think I know the dogs better than the owners. Okay, so, but positive side of energized crowding is economic vitality and growth. I'm drawing on the work of Ed Glaser here. He's an urban economist, probably the top urban economist today. I was prepared to hate this book when it came out, and I loved it. We learn more deeply and thoroughly when we're face-to-face. The externalities of face-to-face interactions create a social multiplier. This is energized crowding. This is increased interactions leads ultimately to economic growth. Hey, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences this year. Okay, so let's change perspectives and look at top-down structures of urban life. And the most important top-down structure is government, the state. And what do states do? Drawing on Charles Tilly here, states exploit people, taxes, coercion, other ways, and they provide services. And the balance between these things sort of identifies the nature of governance. It could also identify your politics today if you think about it a bit. One question archaeologists have asked is, are all early states autocratic? There's a story that all rulers were despots and cruel autocratic kings, you know, like Ramses II here, Yul Brynner. And then the Greeks invented democracy. Yay. Well, actually, we now know that democratic or collective regimes were developed long before the Greeks by many peoples in the ancient world. And forms of ancient government can be arranged on a continuum from autocratic to collective. And this is one of the points made by The Dawn of Everything, that you can have urban societies that have a more collective form of organization. And they say this and think they're very clever for saying it, but Blanton and Farger said this 15 years earlier, said it better with more data. So negative side of government is taxes and exploitation. I was asked to do a paper on Aztec taxation once. I said, okay, nobody had pulled that together. I found 15 different types of taxation in Aztec Central Mexico. So this just shows a few of them. There's a corvée labor group. There's a supervisor organizing 400 workers. They're going to build a temple. On the lower right is a land record showing people along the left and the different types of land each one of them own, because a lot of taxes are based on land. In the top right are bags of cacao beans, which were one of the forms of money and tax good in Aztec Mexico. Monumental architecture results from taxation and exploitation. And whether you're talking about autocratic rule, as in the Maya site of Tikal, or collective rule, as in the Greeks, You need that taxation to build big buildings. Somebody's going to say, well, what about Stonehenge? Well, okay, Stonehenge. You don't actually need a state to build big buildings. But once you have a state, then you have many big buildings getting built. How's that? Now, one person who talks about this is Barnabas Calder in the next talk you're going to hear. His excellent book on architecture and energy. Another negative side of government and states is social classes and inequality. I love this photograph, Toffs and Tufts. And we can identify Toffs and Tufts in many historical periods. Here's a medieval lord and peasant. Here's a scene in Guatemala City today. And archaeologists can study this. So here's a few sites that I've excavated near Cuernavaca, Mexico. Most of the houses there are the houses of the Tufts. They're small one-room structures, but some of them are much bigger houses of the Tufts. So just to give a quick summary here, this is the construction volume that goes into houses. So the top one, which is sites of Cuescomate and Capilco, most houses were quite small with a mean size of 30 cubic meters. But some were much larger. And in fact, these larger houses of the Tofts were the elite residences. Now, Yautepec on the bottom graph there also had a royal palace. And that had 17,000, if we put this on the same graph, it would be over in the next building. And this is what they looked like, a simple house on the bottom, one-room house where most people lived, the commoners, and then the elites, this would have been a rural noble here, group six, were a bunch of structures built on platforms arranged around a patio. You can read about this, it's shameless advertising here, in my book, At Home with the Aztecs, which won an award for best popular archaeology book. Another aspect, the positive side of government is service provision. When people live in cities, there's a lot of things that people live in villages do and you can't do in a city. You can't, at least to the same extent, raise animals and grow your food and make your tools and all this stuff because of the space limitations and specialization. And so services have to be provided. So this city of Bhaktapur, it's in Nepal, every neighborhood has a shrine, a plaza, and a water well. And I did a project, interdisciplinary project, on service provision and with archaeologists, sociologists, policy, and geographer. So just to summarize, you have bottom-up or generative forces, of which energized crowding is one of the most important, and you have top-down or institutional forces, of which government is probably the most prominent. And each of these has both negative and positive features in terms of their impact on the residents. So Teotihuacan to San Diego. If we compare ancient cities to cities today, it's easy to identify the differences. The communications, the technology and industry, the global economy, and for many aspects of cities, that just means that they're not terribly comparable. But on the other hand, human behavior and sociality is basically the same in the past and in the present. Social interactions, the role of energized crowding, which results from population size and density. These are continuities. These applied in cities in the past and cities in the present. Now, I'm going to go through two things that are a little bit complicated. I'm going to go through it very quickly. And what these are features that have been identified for modern cities, and people said, these are features of modern cities only, and we found evidence for them in the past. First one's agglomeration effects. This is increase in productivity when people and firms concentrate spatially. This is, in terms of energized crowding, this is the economic growth aspect of it. Now, Luis Betancourt put forward a model of what's called urban scaling, which is a quantitative method to measure agglomeration effects in groups of cities, published in Science 2013. Now, I want you to work through this example and memorize the formula. There'll be a quiz at the end of my talk. Actually, this looks sort of daunting, and Luis says, oh, I'll step you through it. It's easy. And he goes through it. I can follow it. It's just algebra. That makes sense. Okay, yeah. And then 15 minutes later, it's what? But basically, what Betancourt says is that the way people move through cities, movement has a cost, social interaction has a benefit. You estimate these and work the algebra, and you come up with certain predictions which work for modern cities. And he said, well, would these work for ancient cities? And so Scott Ortman was an archaeologist at the Santa Fe Institute. That's where these guys are affiliated. First applied it to archaeology, and it seemed to work. So they invited me up there, and I joined them, and And we have a project, Social Reactors Project. All our publications are on this website, University of Colorado. But this is the prediction of Betancourt's model. You have, these are for settlement systems, and we have everything from Peru to China to Missouri, Mesa Verde, the Roman Empire, medieval Europe. We have a lot of different cases that we have run, and the predicted value for Betancourt's equations are sort of in this band, and most of these cases are right in there. In other words, ancient settlement systems conform to this model, which was first derived to analyze modern settlement systems. There's something fundamental going on in city systems in the past and the present, and that something has to do with the way people interact. Now, pay no attention to the Maya there. They don't fit. But I wasn't going to cut them off of the graph, but it doesn't fit for everything, okay? Works for a lot of sites, but not everything. All right, second one is spatial equilibrium. This is a notion in economics today where the land in a city and the people's activities in a city sort of balance out spatially. And to do this, archaeologically, you need a city that has a really good map. Well, we have Teotihuacan, mapped by Rene Millen and George Kogel. And they published the map, we digitized it and analyzed it. And basically, spatial equilibrium predicts that you're going to have a density gradient. That means the population density declines exponentially from the center of the city to the edge of the city. Basically, me and some students produced this map, and we showed it to an economist. He goes, oh my God, spatial equilibrium, density gradient. And so we found that we were able to use these methods of economics to analyze the settlement. There's a number of modern cities from Barcelona, Prague, and economists say these density gradients are due to wage labor, private property, and modern transportation. Well, what if we do this for Teotihuacan? We get the same pattern. We get the exact same pattern. Teotihuacan did not have wage labor, did not have private property, did not have modern transportation. What's going on? Something more fundamental is going on. It's these regularities and energized crowding and social interactions. For my final point, as global warming proceeds, where does the shit hit the fan? It is the greatest impact on the greatest number of peoples on the cities in the developing world. So, do ancient cities have anything to contribute here? Can ancient cities say anything about adaptations to climate change and shocks? So we put a project together, we published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The idea is that any city that's been around a long time, and guess what, we have evidence for this archaeologically, has faced a number of shocks and found a way to deal with them. So if we can figure out why some cities lasted longer than others, that might help us understand how cities deal with shocks. And we used a bunch of archaeological surveys. Here's a survey I directed in the Yautepec Valley. We plotted the sites, the Yautepec Valley on the bottom here and some others. What's the median site persistence? How long did sites last in these different regions? And there's a lot of variation. We wanted to pursue this with the National Science Foundation. They didn't want to give us the money. That's another story. So, can findings about the persistence of ancient cities inform research on urban climate change adaptations? And well, if there is anything here, I mean, the jury is out, but if there is anything here, top-down forces and bottom-up forces are going to be part of the story, and how we construct our world is certainly part of the story. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.